Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Anyone who has known the communal bliss of a rave, a happening, a Grateful Dead concert, a Hasidic wedding, Day of the Dead in Oaxaca, knows the importance of ritual and ritual dance and shared ecstasy. Prehistoric people threatened by food shortages, diseases, and wild animals, as author Barbara Ehrenreich points out, made that shared ritual a priority in their lives. Why, she asks, is it less of a priority for 21st century people? If ecstatic rituals and festivities were once so widespread, why so little of them left today? Barbara Ehrenreich last spoke to us from the stage as part of the Big Questions lecture series in 1999 on the topic, Why Do We Love War? This was a subject that she'd explored in her book, Blood Rites, Origins and Histories of the Passions of War. The book she'll discuss tonight with anthropologist Amy Parrish, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, has its roots, its intellectual roots, in that earlier study. Barbara Ehrenreich is a political essayist and social critic. Her articles, reviews, and essays have been widely published. She's the author of 14 books, including the New York Times bestseller Nickel and Dimed, A Trenchant Examination of Working Class Poverty, and the New York Times bestseller Bait and Switch, which exposed the ever more prevalent phenomenon of white-collar unemployment. She has a PhD in biology from the Rockefeller University and has been the recipient of numerous grants and awards. In conversation with her tonight is Dr. Amy Parrish, a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist, who teaches at the University of Southern California in the Gender Studies and Anthropology departments. Amy Parrish has been studying the world's captive population of bonobos for the last 15 years, and she's also studied the mating system of white-handed gibbons. Am I saying that right? In a rainforest in Thailand for 2.5 years. In all of her research, she uses an evolutionary approach to shed light on the origins of human behavior. She currently teaches courses at USC on love, marriage, and the experience of being a wife, and on the cultural impact of Darwin's theories. Please welcome Barbara Ehrenreich and Amy Parrish.
Thank you, everyone, for being here tonight. It's a real pleasure to have an opportunity to have a dialogue with Barbara Ehrenreich. I've been a fan of her work for years. Love the book, For Her Own Good, 150 Years of Experts' Advice to Women. And this is a really nice trajectory to be here tonight to talk about her newest book, Dancing in the Streets, which follows from Blood Rites, maybe not completely chronologically, but is a really nice follow-up that can give us another perspective on the human endeavor and where we might go in the future. So I thought I might start tonight by explaining that I just put together a PowerPoint that will show in the background of some images of different rituals, human rituals in different cultures, with a little bit of explanation. Those will be coming up shortly. Most of those are images from a German colleague named Volker Sommer, who has a book called Festa Ritual, Festivals, Myths, and Rituals, in, that's published by GEO, the German version of National Geographic. So those will be showing in the background, not necessarily in order of what we're discussing here between us, but at some point those will come up. So I thought we'd start tonight with a definition of what collective joy is, because this is really a term that you yourself invented. Could we talk a little bit about why it's something that wasn't in our vocabulary before and exactly what it means?
Well, I think it's sort of symptomatic that the term doesn't mean much, you know, or that I had to come up with some kind of phrase. So I've been working on this book for 8 or 9 years, and people would say, what are you working on? I'd say, oh, it's about collective joy. I'd say, huh? You know, and that just says, you know, how little we have it, how little it is expressed in our society. We have no way of talking about it. And I contrast to all the very rich ways we have of talking about, the love or the connections between two individuals, sexual love. And we can talk about the romance, we can talk about affection, and all the way to obsessive love and violent kinds of encounters. We have very little way of talking about that an interaction between larger numbers of people.
And that may be part of an outgrowth of our sort of capitalistic society, right? That as we became more industrialized and didn't live in kin groups anymore, that there was much more of an emphasis on the heterosexual pair bond and less of an emphasis on the collective whole?
Well, I put a little more sharply that one of the things that happened with the Industrial Revolution, although this had begun long ago, was within Europe a real stamping out of anything that was left of the festive tradition. And my book basically, you know, it's an attempt to answer that question that Louise put. If this is something so fundamental to human experience, why is there so little of it? So I'm tracing the repression of ecstatic rituals and festivities throughout mostly global history. It's not too good on some spots in the globe, I'll admit. But with the Industrial Revolution, it's like the end, because the theme of the Industrial Revolution is now that people have to work 6 days a week and spend the seventh sitting in a church. You know, that was hard to convince people to, really hard. It goes against human nature. Because, you know, before that, in agricultural Europe, just to stick to Europe for a while, people, you know, worked when they had to. The planting, the harvest, things like that. But you didn't just get up in the morning and say, I'm going to go to work. What's that about? You know, this is a...
Right, and for most of human existence, we lived in a sort of hunter-gatherer or forager lifestyle where some anthropologists have called it the Zen road to affluence. You have a lot by wanting little. And work was a means of subsistence, but not a means of self-gratification. So maybe we could start before Europe, or talk about some of the early explorers, and you have a nice description from Herman Melville in here about his observance of a ritual in Tahiti, and it's a dance called the Lori Lori, and it's a dance that the Tahitian women do, and he describes it as, presently, raising a strange chant, they softly sway themselves, gradually quickening the movement, until at length, for a few passionate moments, with throbbing bosoms and glowing cheeks, they abandon themselves to the spirit of the dance, apparently lost to everything around. But soon subsiding again into the same languid measures as before, the eyes swimming in their heads, join in one wild chorus, and sink into each other's arms.
Yeah, I started with these scenes from colonialist or imperialist sorts of encounters that in the 16th through the 19th centuries, Europeans, as you know, fanned out all over the globe and, basically destroyed the cultures they came across. But along the way, we get reports of something that struck these Europeans as very peculiar and as almost the hallmark of the, quote, savage. Wherever they went, Polynesia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Alaska, India, they found people performing danced rituals or having festivities that involved dance, generally feasting, masking, costuming, face paint. And the Europeans looked at this and said, "These, you know, this proves the inherent inferiority of other peoples than ourselves, people of color, because we don't do this. We get self-control." That's how they saw it. So it's actually a kind of study in racism, the way they thought about these rituals that they saw and these festivities, how grotesque and savage they found them, the kinds of words they used. So one of the first things that intrigued me was then to go back into European history and ancient history even, and see how this was very much had been a European kind of tradition too. They were completely wrong.
And so that follows then into an age where anthropologists become interested in sort of cataloging the world's rituals and seeing maybe the capacity to perform rituals and to engage in sort of collective ecstasy as almost a human universal. Would you say that that's
true? I think universal is fair to say. There may be an exception somewhere. Bone I have to pick with anthropologists. I have a few bones to pick with anthropologists.
All right.
I don't think you're going to have to take the brunt of this, but, you know, they'll say, kind of casually over and over, that, yeah, most people have these sorts of things where they did the dancing, the feasting, the costuming, the masking, maybe processions, maybe some drama, maybe some comedy, and they'll go right by. That's not interesting. You know, that's fascinating. But even Victor Turner, who was the anthropologist most credited with looking at these kind of collective ecstatic things, he would go through great detail describing other aspects of ritual among, was it the Ndemba people? Of where in Africa? Test. See if you're really an anthropologist. I don't know.
I'm a biological anthropologist.
He described all these aspects of ritual, symbolic manipulations of, you know, certain things. And then he'd say, and then the drums came out and the dancing started. End of his description. Just wasn't interesting.
It was a side note. And yet he did at least think about what the function and the significance might be, right, for ritual expression. Do you want to talk a little bit about...
Well, he talked about it generating communitas. That was his word for what we might call a collective excitement or joy. And... you know, he saw it as a way, as other anthropologists have seen it, a way of binding groups together. How do you bond people together? This, according to, an evolutionary biologist, Robin Dunbar?
Yes.
One of the crucial assets that humans have had was the ability to form groups larger than just kinship groups, to form bigger and bigger groups. And the way that we apparently have done that is through these kinds of rituals that bring people together.
So we are a species that is very good at forming what you might call fictive kinship relationships. In other animals, the best predictor of bonding is whether you're related to the individuals that you're with, and that's where you see the closest bonds. So if you're a biologist and you go into the forest and you see that the females are the most friendly with each other, then you would be pretty safe in assuming that they're the sex that does not disperse at adolescence, that they're the sex that lives with their kin for life. Humans are really interesting because we have this ability to extend that kind of behavior to non-kin, and there are just a few other species, including the bonobo, who are able to really do that systematically. And we also have this other really unique ability to have relationships even with people we've never met. So you might know about a cousin or an aunt or an uncle that you have that lives over in Ireland, even if you've never met that individual. If you go there and knock on her door, you're going to have an instant relationship. And so we kind of have some interesting groundwork there that then might be utilized in some of the kinds of ritualistic and ecstatic expressions that we see around the world. And this is just a small sampling going on behind us, not necessarily in any kind of order for the directly follows the book.
But one of the ways to bond with strangers rather quickly is through these kinds of festivities and rituals. And it finally hit me that one of the big functions of masks is not only to make people you see every day look suddenly more interesting and peculiar, you know, but also just to dissolve the difference between stranger and friend or kin. Because somebody comes along at a mask, doesn't matter anymore. You know, that the other identities are gone.
And it's also a great leveling mechanism, isn't it? So if you live in a highly stratified society, but you have a ritual where everybody's coming out into the streets together with masks on, does that sort of equalize the situation?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that elites feared about these kinds of festivities. Actually, just remembering a wonderful movie scene, is it Princess Margot or Queen Margot, the wonderful... Huh? Help me. We're near Hollywood. Queen Margot. Where in the very beginning of that, it's a French movie, she and her lady-in-waiting put on masks and go out among the common people at a carnival in Paris so she can pick up guys. And, you know, that. So she is a... you know, high-ranking person, but she has this, she can just enter in to the fun with the common people through masking. But it's the very leveling effect, the egalitarian nature of festivities that has frightened elites. And their first tendency is just to draw back. So you find an Arab upper class in parts of Africa deciding not to participate in festivities. They will stay indoors. You find it in late medieval Europe, the elites withdrawing to their own banquets and balls, not wanting to be outdoors among the hoi polloi. And as a perfect example right now, or in the last, I don't know how many years, which is at stadiums, sports events, which have a carnivalesque, you know, sport games now have a carnivalesque aspect, is that the elite go into their skyboxes. They don't do the wave with everybody else or something. They don't paint their faces. They're in their little skybox, you know, drinking and being served hors d'oeuvres and stuff.
And you have a great description in the book of King David going out for some celebration in the streets of Jerusalem and acting like a commoner. Do you think you could?
Yeah. This is an example of the way elites will look down on some of these things. I forget who David has just triumphed over, Philistines. And so he dances near naked down the street of main street of Jerusalem, comes back to his wife. Help me. Who is his wife?
Micah.
Thank you. And she says, well, you sure made a fool of yourself, you know, acting like a common person dancing in the street. That's why he dumped her, by the way. Remember? And he gets rid of Uriah. Anyway, I don't want to go off into biblical gossip here, but...
All right, well, maybe we can step back then. So we have the early explorers really seeing that expression of ecstatic joy and ritual as the experience of the other, of the savage, of the non-civilized. Then we have the anthropologists really recognizing that that this is a component of all human groups in some form or another. And then we have the psychologists who have an even different take. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Well, psychologists haven't been much help on this subject. Social psychologists a little bit, because they've looked at things that are interesting like mood contagion. But psychology has been dominated, so you know, such a heavy influence of Freud, who could not understand collective behavior or festive behavior. He writes to his fiancée and says something very disparaging about a fair you know, and how disorderly these things are and low class they are. Not like the things you and I, Martha, he says, enjoy, that such as reading a good book inside, you know, and that's inside the house. And then when he does contemplate any kind of collective behavior, all he can think of is crowds manipulated by demagogues, or as he put it in the case of the, indigenous people, witch doctors, had to be manipulated, could not be something egalitarian and, warm and real between people.
And again, maybe that's another expression of discomfort with the power that comes from collective ritual and the powers of the masses.
Yes, although the European middle class, bourgeoisie, whatever, you know, really internalized this idea that collective joy or something was an expression of the savage other. Of people of color, of or of their own lower classes. So that being haughty, standing off from that, being self-controlled was almost the definition of being civilized and white.
And that's another hallmark of human behavior, is that we have this real drive to acquire status. And so probably even more so than, say, a biological ticking clock to have children, which evolution never really had to produce, because until 50 years ago, you had kids whether you wanted to or not, as long as you weren't celibate. Throughout time, being higher status has always resulted in higher reproductive success. And even in things like who got off the Titanic, well, it was the high-status people, and so their genes survived to perpetuate themselves. And that brings me to the point in your book where you start talking about a biological perspective or a scientific perspective on this kind of human behavior. So I know you mentioned some explanations that might be considered natural selection that have to do with survival of the group.
Yeah, well, it was... being a biologist too, and a lapsed biologist, but nonetheless, I'm always interested what might be the evolutionary roots of some kinds of behavior, as you are, clearly. And I mentioned the probable importance of festivities and rituals in forming larger groups for purposes of defense, Early humans had to defend themselves against predator animals and probably against other bands of humans or other kinds of hominids even. We don't know what all the threats were. So that's probably the selective pressure. But why these particular things like music and dance, which are, I should say, unique to humans? Well, all right, birds sing, and there are other sort of musical things, but we are the only creature that can do rhythmic synchronizations. Your bonobos can't do it, right? I'm not.
That's true.
Not putting them nothing down or anything. The greatest respect for bonobos, but like chimps, they got no rhythm. They can't. they can hop around and do their pant hoots and wave their arms, but they cannot kind of really boogie to music. We can't all either. I admit that. I'm a little weak on that myself. But, it's very fascinating because, especially when you think what a huge caloric expenditure these sort of ecstatic rituals and festivities involve. You have people... this is not spontaneous stuff. You got to work on your costumes. You got to work on your musical instruments. You got to work on your dance steps and your rhythms. And it's always bothered anthropologists. Why are they doing this? Why aren't they doing something useful? That's what anthropologists think. They're my conjecture is that in part, it was that rhythmic synchronized activity that may have been useful originally in defense in itself, not just as a means to group larger group formation, that it's possible that a group of humans moving synchronously and rhythmically together could convince a predator animal that they weren't just individual weak beings, because we are pretty weak individually, but that they were one big thing. The form of size deception, which, you know, other species have their forms of size deception. That I have, you know, more backup for that wild speculation in the book, but I do want to do the experiment. I want volunteers. One group who's going to face down tigers just standing still. Another group that's going to hop around crazy like chimps. And a group that's got rhythm. We're going to see who survives.
So it's a survival of the fittest, for sure. Well, so, yeah, those sometimes it's hard to use natural selection to explain a phenomenon, because if it doesn't seem to promote survival value, then you wonder how those genes are perpetuated in the next generation. So, for instance, with male peacock tails, they're very long, they're expensive to grow, they're heavy, the males can hardly fly away. Darwin hated peacocks. In fact, he said he despised peacocks because he couldn't imagine how this trait was surviving from generation to generation. And that led him to the other one of his major ideas, which was his idea of sexual selection, that sometimes you can have a trait that isn't even adaptive in a survival kind of sense, but if it helps you to attract members of the opposite sex, then it's a price worth paying. And you also talk in your book about maybe some sexual selection aspects of the propensity to engage in ecstatic practices.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at pop singers as celebrities in our own culture. You know, that those abilities, those musical abilities, whether they are signals of reproductive fitness or not, we go for them, you know.
Yeah, those kinds of symbols are very attractive, and I think anybody who's been to high school has seen a lot of what you might call display going on, right? Particularly young males displaying to young females, although in the case of humans, both sexes try to appeal to the other sex, and some of that's very ritualized in the way that males behave and compete with each other over access to females. I know there are some anthropologists looking at some of the groups in Africa, like the Datoke, which live in Tanzania, where one of their dancing rituals is to gather under the midday sun and basically leap up and down straight up and down in the air for about an hour while there's some drumming going on. And that's a pretty good display of your status and your fitness, right? I mean, anybody who can do that is obviously pretty parasite-free and pretty good health. There's a lot of competition over how high you can jump. It's a really good way of advertising to everybody out there that maybe you're a good mate.
Does it test for STDs, too?
I don't know. You know, I think just overall fitness, of which that would be one component, perhaps. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the different ways that humans express ecstatic pleasure. So I know you're particularly interested in dance, but you also talk about trance. And we have, I think, if it'll play, a little video clip of a Kung healer. They're actually called the Kung because it's a click language in the Kalahari. And this man is trying to heal a woman who's in childbirth and in distress, and the baby is not arriving. And so he goes into a trance to try to help deliver the baby. So we're not sure if it's going to play because I gave it to them at the last minute. So it's not Russell's fault if it doesn't. But maybe we can try it. We'll see if it's going to work. Do we have sound or no sound?
Is that the healer?
Yes. And that's the pregnant woman there. And it's really too bad we don't have the sound, because that's a pretty big part of the trance. But he gets down and he's going to tell the baby that it's safe to come out, that there are no evil spirits. And basically he begins to wail. All the young girls are told not to come and witness this, because if they haven't given birth yet, they will become afraid of childbirth. So, but some girls come anyway. And there he is getting ready. He begins to tremble. For years, he trained to become one of these shamanistic healers. And there he is talking to the baby by basically howling into her stomach. And he tells the evil spirits to go away. And it's a sort of laying on of hands experience, where he almost begins to froth at the mouth. And you can tell it's a kind of out-of-body experience for him to be able to transfer that energy to her. He began his training when he was quite young. He was married at 13. To a woman named Nai, and she at first was very afraid of this behavior, and only later the group began to explain to her that this was not something that she had to be afraid of. That's Nai right there. So I think we can stop the video. Sorry that there was no sound for that. It's only, there he is a little bit. It's only later that the group explains to her what an important function that is in the group to be able to heal people through these kinds of trances. So would you like to say anything about trances in particular? I know you cover them.
Well, I'm thinking of the book called Boiling Energy, and I can't remember the name of the author. It's in the bibliography here, but he wrote about the Kung people, if I'm saying it right, the Kalahari, and their danced rituals. Usually it would be dancing that he describes, and this anthropologist participated in the danced rituals, are supposed to be healing rituals. They're not conceived as religious. They're not conceived as recreational. They're conceived of as healing. And various people will go off into trances during them, which is very important to the healing process. And trance here, means as seen from the outside, the person may fall on the ground, they may go into kinds of postures that they would or contortions that they wouldn't do otherwise. They may foam at the mouth, their eyes might roll. It's I've seen, and this is, boy, did that horrify the European explorers, that. Although there were plenty of examples of this in Europe too, that sort of thing, which is the end point of some ecstatic rituals, not all, and it's very culturally determined. In the Kung people, might expect it at some forms of Pentecostal worship. It might be expected and a good thing. For you could go into a trance-like state of union with a deity. In voodoo ritual, that would be a wonderful thing to have happened to you. But if you were at a sporting event, doing a wave and wearing face paint for, who do you have here, the Lakers or somebody, you probably wouldn't go into a trance. It would be, culturally, that would not be appropriate.
That's an interesting question. I was trying to think if I've ever actually had an experience of real collective joy, some kind of ecstatic experience like that. And I would come from sort of a puritanical, waspish past. So, what experiences would those be? And I think about the things that have made me happiest recently, which would be, a lecture that Ariel Levy gave last week at USC. I was really, really energized by when I left, and I thought, wow,
it was
so fantastic.
Rise up and start dancing.
practically. It was about the rise of ranch culture. But, I haven't had the kind of experiences that you've had in this book, or that you've described in this book. I guess, could you either describe an experience that you've had or one that you would like to be a part of?
Well, my glimpses into this go back to the 1960s and have to do with rock and roll. Yeah, okay. And as I did more research for this book, I was fascinated to see to read about the rock rebellion going back into the 50s now, which meant audiences of kids were suddenly refusing to accept the concert as a spectacle. They refused to sit down. They would get up out of their seats and dance in the aisle. Police would be called. Again, police were routine presences at rock concerts well into the 60s because of this problem of people getting up, not allowed. And yet, the more I learned, the more I realized that the roots of rock are in, or most of the roots are in West African kind of music that went with ecstatic danced religions. It is not kind of beat that you can sit still to and has not been for centuries, So those were my kinds of glimpses, I would say.
When I was an undergrad, I had a class with a cultural anthropologist named Conrad Kotak, who works in Madagascar with a group where when a relative dies, you put the body in a hut for a year, and then when just the bones are left, you go and you bundle them up, and they go in a special bone hut. And once a year, on a particular day, you get the bones out and you dance with them, to remember your relatives. And he said that he had put in his will that he wanted to have his bones danced with every year over in Madagascar in one of the bone huts. So I think, there are some interesting rituals out there that we all might want to take part in. I think maybe the other... the other.
I'm not doing that to my grandkids, I'm sorry.
The only other time I think I've really felt that kind of collective experience was actually an experience I had with some bonobos where Louise had a bunch of celery and I wanted her to look at me so I could take a picture of her because the green looked so nice against her black hair. And I kept saying her name and she wouldn't look at me. And she was just kind of ignoring me and eating her celery. And finally, I kept pestering her, so she stood up and ripped the celery in half and threw half to me. So she thought I'd been begging the whole time, which wasn't my intent and never occurred to me that she would think that. But it really made me feel as though she were including me in that sisterhood. And that was a really nice moment because, I'd never shared any food with them. And it was just nice to know that she would do that for me. So what's happened to us that in the past we had all these great rituals and all this ecstasy, and now things are kind of dampened, aside from rock and roll, but it seems as though as you progress through the timeline of the book, there's less and less, at least here in this culture, of that kind of ecstatic ritual.
Yeah, but I end on a sort of positive note that these things are sort of irrepressible. I think the capacity for collective joy is hardwired. Those techniques of creating it through the music and everything else are cultural, of course, but we keep finding them again. And I mentioned the rock rebellion. I talk about what I call the carnivalization of sports events, beginning in really the 1980s in this country. People beginning to reject the spectator role at the stadium, painting their faces, costuming in team colors, crazy head gear. It didn't hurt that rock and roll was increasing, being blasted into those stadia also, and then engaging in rhythmic motions like the wave or some other kinds of even more elaborate things in England and in South America. People dance in the aisle. People bring their drums to the bleachers and dance during the soccer game. So this is people saying, no, we're not just passive spectators. And then we have sorts of celebrations that come out of nowhere, that have no particular roots. One, if I don't mention this, there's always somebody in an audience who's going to stand up and say, what about Burning Man? Okay, Burning Man. And the Berlin Love Fest, which is not so familiar to us Americans, but up to 1 million people a year will gather annually in Berlin for these just huge dancing in the streets, rock and roll blowout. And then I think we owe gay culture quite a bit for like turning Halloween more into an adult holiday and kind of licensing that idea that you're never too old to be out there in a costume or partly naked in the streets or whatever. Is this my cue to read the last couple of paragraphs here?
And then we'll take some questions from the audience.
A couple of years ago on the stunning Copacabana beach in Rio de Janeiro, where the mountains march right down to the water, my companion and I were drawn by the sound of drumming. Walking north along the beach, we came to a phalanx of samba dancers, about 10 people abreast and at least a block long, members of a samba school practicing for Carnival, we were told. There were people of all ages, from tots of 4 or 5 up to octogenarians, men and women, some gorgeously costumed and some in the tank tops and shorts that constitute Rio street clothes, to a 19th century missionary or even a 21st century religious Puritan, their movements might well have seemed lewd or at least suggestive. Certainly the conquest of the streets by a crowd of brown-skinned people would have been distressing in itself. But the samba school danced down to the sand in perfect dignity, wrapped in their own rhythm, their faces both exhausted and shining with an almost religious kind of exaltation. One thin latte-colored young man dancing just behind the musician set the pace. What was he in real life? A bank clerk? A busboy? But here, in his brilliantly feathered costume, he was a prince, a mythological figure, maybe even a god. Here for a moment, there were no divisions among people except for the playful ones created by Carnival itself. As they reached the boardwalk, bystanders started falling into the rhythm too, and without any invitation or announcements, without embarrassment or even alcohol to dissolve the normal constraints of urban life, the samba school turned into a crowd, and the crowd turned into a momentary festival. There was no, quote, point to it. No religious overtones, ideological message, or money to be made. Just the chance, which we need much more of on this crowded planet, to acknowledge the miracle of our simultaneous existence with some sort of celebration. And if you're wondering whether I joined in to the dance, the answer is no, because my companion was my son, who's sitting right back over there, and, you know, how embarrassing would that be? I mean, your mom doing it.
Well, we'd like to take a few questions from the audience. Margaret's going to walk around with the mic. How about you in the red shirt, and then we'll move around a little bit.
I'm wondering if you have ever gone to either a jazz funeral in New Orleans or to the Indians Rising on St. Joseph's Day down there.
No, I don't. It's in my itinerary to go to New Orleans, and my publisher's going to pay my way. I don't really want to go to Mardi Gras. What I'm interested in is the far less commercialized second-line celebrations, which are like, you know, may have originated or are connected with those jazz funerals. But this is dancing in the streets, it's costuming, it's drinking, it's just people pouring through the streets, and I have a good friend who's going to set me up with this. You can't be heard
here
anymore.
in the room.
Yeah, how do these egalitarian festivals get transformed into hierarchical ones? I mean, the thing that Freud was afraid of was the boss or the leader, the orchestra leader of these festivals, and Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the how is different. You know, there's historically different stories to go with lots of things. But here's a vivid example, football. Football, say, 300-400 years ago, as played in northern France and in England, was a game played by hundreds of people on a side. Whole villages went against each other. Men, women, children, and priests. It was a melee. This, you know, turned into a, quote, spectator sport. One of the fears about it, and one of the problems, you know, with a lot of these festivities, was a fear of these things turning into uprisings. And in fact, some of those mass football matches were occasions to attack, you know, the nobility or to attack the mills once you have industrialization. So it's a, you have to go with each.
You know, how about here in the second row, and then we'll come down.
I listened to you earlier on the radio today, and you were talking about how there's been a strong history of women dancing together. And I'm wondering if you think there's any correlation to women being suppressed at all for that, or if there's any correlation with the witch trials and dancing and women dancing.
Yeah, and here maybe Amy would want to throw in some interesting things about bonobos, females. The example that I devote part of a chapter to is the Dionysian worship in ancient Greece, which was primarily women, and they could, you know, they would, at some kind of signal, which is a whole other story, they would drop their domestic chores, run off into the woods, run into the mountaintops, for days and nights of wild revelry in the worship of Dionysus. So their husbands complained. They could just say, hey, we've got to worship the god. You know, this is what we're doing. They had a god of ecstasy, Dionysus. You want to throw in a little...
I don't know if bonobo females... I don't know if they have a god of ecstasy, but they certainly practice ecstasy. And one way that females solidify their relationships is through having sex with each other. They do something called Gigi rubbing, where they embrace and they rub their genitals together. And given a choice between a male and a female partner, they're much more likely to pick the female than the male. So it helps provide tension reduction during times when they would have to negotiate over food or aggression. And then that helps them form bonds so that they can act like sisters, even though they're not. They're not kin. But really, they kind of embody the message of the human feminist movement, which is behave with unrelated females as if they are your sisters, and there's real power in that. And humans, to the extent that they do it through things like dancing and bonding and rituals, and that really helps them. Aside from having kin, the best way to empower females is to cooperate with other females.
Or have sex with them. That's what you're just saying. Yeah. I have, you know, Amy, I can't resist. I have to ask you the allergy question. Did you ever have sex with your bonobos?
No. There's all kinds of rumors, you know, that maybe, not about me, but about, you know, the Chinese or the Russians, you know, created a hybrid between a human and a bonobo. They actually have a different number of pairs of chromosomes than we do. It's possible that maybe we could hybridize.
No, I meant just the GG stuff.
Just the GG. No, but certainly, if there's something you didn't know in the sexual repertoire, watching bonobos would teach it to you, for sure.
Science at work.
How about down here in the front? There's two. If I'm missing anybody over here, wave wildly. Okay, we'll come there next.
A comment and then a couple of questions. One piece of evidence about, you talked about uprisings. The recent film, The U.S. versus John Lennon, shows how people in power are very much afraid of uprisings that might spontaneously occur. My question is more to the quantum level, which, as a biologist, I'm curious about. I'm not a biologist, I mean you. do you think it's possible that what we have stifled as Westerners, as Anglos, whatever you, however you, white people, is that the true notion that what's going on is the ecstasy is going on in the universe, and somehow we're missing out on this by suppressing these things through our religious and cultural indoctrinations. A friend of mine who's done a lot of study on this is saying that the double helix of the DNA is a dance of ecstasy, and that there is evidence also in the universe of these spherical particles moving in different directions and dancing ecstatically with each other. Isn't that an expression of what's inherently possible for us as human beings?
Very good. I throw this to you too, Amy, but maybe I'm too much of a scientist, but I think of a double helix and I just think of hydrogen bonds between, you know, between the bases. And we have no evidence, unfortunately, of feelings in the universe other than our own and those of the animal, other animals on the earth. But I open it up to you as a fellow scientist.
I also tend to be fairly empirical about those things, although I appreciate the metaphor of what you're saying, and it would be nice if things were like that. I mean, I guess there is some evidence that genes can cooperate or sort of act in concert with each other, that it's not all individualistic competition, and that's something we didn't get to touch too much on here, but there's some nice parallels between Barbara's comparison of sort of the individualistic behavior that many of us engage in today and this collective whole with science, where we tend to also focus on competition and survival of the fittest, and yet there's so much cooperation around us. I mean, I drove up from San Diego. There were probably 3,000 other people on the road cooperating with me and not running into me and following the same rules. And, you know, it's remarkable how much we cooperate on a daily basis. So it is out there. I don't know on the cosmic level, but it's definitely something that's worth paying attention to. I did want to at least get somebody from way over here. Did you still? No? Okay. The question is, what's a bonobo? I apologize. A bonobo is a relative of the chimpanzee and a relative of the human. They're, along with chimps, our closest living relative. They look a lot like a chimp, but their behavior is different in the ways that we've been discussing.
They're female-dominated.
Yes, which not all scientists, particularly male scientists, are comfortable admitting. And so, for instance, it's been called strategic male deference instead. talk about a euphemism. I think there was somebody here in the middle in the blue, back behind you. And then
I have two questions about your definitions. One on how you define dance, if you're just defining it as rhythmic movement. There are definitely some animals, for example, bees, that do a sort of type of dance for communication. So would that exclude a type of animal?
And what two animals dance?
Bees.
Honeybees?
Honeybees. For communication purposes. And two, on your definition of joy, I find it interesting that you call your book Collective Joy, because that's sort of projecting an emotion on a collective behavior, and I'm not sure if that's, you know, if joy is always appropriate in some collective behaviors.
Let me just say something about bees dancing, and I might need help here, but it's been a long time since I've read about that. That, I think, is an individual bee making particular motions to indicate where its food source is in relationship to the sun. It's not something of a lot of bees, you know, doing it together, right?
That's true. Right. Yeah, okay. It seems pretty functional.
Yeah. And then collective joy, am I projecting an emotion onto behavior? Well, see, I'm just trying. I think I just want to, you know, emphasize that it's in a group. I'm talking about joy that we experience in a group. There's all kinds of joy you can experience as an individual. I'm not ruling that out. But I want to just distinguish, this is something that we derive from other humans, something very important to how we bond as humans.
Okay. Let's see. I promised the man here in the front row, and then I'll come over here. Sorry, I hate to be the one over there. We haven't gotten anybody over here yet. So, great. Okay.
Thank you for keeping your word. It's a rarity in Los Angeles. But may I compliment
promising him.
May I compliment you on the body of your work? I think it's absolutely very penetrating and very, very in-depth. Brushing aside all the frailties, but getting into the subconscious of the collective human being, it's most impressive. It's been very rewarding for me to know your work. May I be greedy and ask two fairly oddball questions? One in terms of the rock concerts. As a biologist on an empirical level, would you comment briefly, if you would, on that it might, the influence of just the biochemistry, the collective biochemistry, which is possibly might have a collective expression with a very limited amount of music. In other words, the larger the crowd. I have seen it take over just by the collection of biochemical rhythms in a large amount of people. The other one is an oddball question. Again, please be patient with it. There is a rarity in the American collective consciousness in groups, which I find slightly bizarre, and if I may just phrase it briefly, it's this indulgence of seminar, almost manipulative seminar, long range, 48 hours, weekends, stress provocative events, which at the end of which produces a kind of almost a climax of a presumptuous enlightenment on the basis of rising to a new level, if I may put it that way. It seems to be American. Now I've seen groups of it through my work or whatever, where they're getting to be groups of 200, 300 people. Even more fanatical.
Oh.
Est is like tea room compared to some of these groups. Mm. If that's a fair question, and thank you for your patience.
The first part, obviously the biology of this did fascinate me. Biochemistry, I have no doubt endorphins are involved in some way. But more interesting to me is the role of mirror neurons, which have become highly fashionable right now, so much so I'm a little doubtful of them. But that there are neurons, groups of neurons in our heads that, to put it very, very simply for this purpose, respond to the motion of another person, or it could be another primate, getting ready to announce, to give orders for you to do the same motions. So that if I see one of you in the audience like this, and you see me do it, there are some neurons in your head saying, do that, you know? Pay no attention to them. But, that we're that tightly linked. I talk about that a little bit. As for the other phenomenon, it's sort of a brainwashing effect, really, when you take people and put them in a seminar and isolate them from others for a long time, they'll come out. I mean, this is the downside of how sociable we are, is that we will give up even empirical reality to agree with a group in some way,
Good way to put it. Let's go here, and then I'll come over there. Second row here, I think, and then, yeah.
You know, this is very interesting for me because I was an anthropology major at UCLA, and back in the mid-90s, I participated in a men's group weekend, one of these endurance events you're talking about. And at the end of it, we had some group dancing, which is unfamiliar to me, and that was really nice. And part of me is still, not aloof, but kind of monitoring this from a social point of view. And then at the end, we had a drum out, and it was like nothing I had ever experienced before. It started soft, and then it went to incredible loudness of us drumming and dancing back and forth. I lost my mind. It was gone for a while. And I had never had that experience before. And it was so many people were breaking down. Guys were crying. I'm holding, oh, you're okay. I mean, it was just, and I have never had that. And part of me is just kind of like suspicious. I've been trained. I was suspicious of that whole experience. I loved it. But I never knew exactly how to make sense of it. But part of me still longed for it. But anyway, this is not even a question, just so much of an observation, that hearing this, which I didn't even know what the topic was when we came, because I just read some of your other books and loved it, it makes me curious about how to bring this in to your life. But part of me is always suspicious that things could get out of control. It's just, I don't know what your experience is, as far as incorporating more into your life. Are you also suspicious? So,
well, I think some of that suspicion, it is coming from this whole Western orientation, and you know that, hey, you admitted you were a graduate student in anthropology, right? Right. You know, and we're actually, it's sort of worse than that. I mean, that since World War II, there's been a strong bias, say, in the academy to think of any collective phenomena as suspect, as reeking of fascism. And I spend quite some time in this book on that, showing that what the fascists were good at and the Nazis were good at was not collective ritual or ecstatic anything, but spectacle. Nuremberg was actually extremely boring. You know, it was not about moving around. It was about standing still and basically watching soldiers march by you or listening to speech after speech at night. So, I mean, this is a very deep bias, I think, that we have. But I don't know about men's groups. I would have been a little suspicious. No. It's like,
all right.
I don't really know what men do when they're all by themselves, but I have suspicions.
And there was somebody from this section here, third row there, maybe. Okay, and this will be the last one. I apologize to those we couldn't get to.
Hi, I have sort of a ill-formed question for you. But I was thinking, when I heard the title of the lecture tonight, I was thinking in terms of TV. And you've talked repeatedly about festival versus spectacle. But could you imagine a way in which, like, collective TV watching actually is sort of a collective festive event, especially if it's comedy? Everybody goes through the ritual. They sit in a certain fashion. They have sort of canned responses or even like creative responses. So they can be individual, you know, intellectual, personal responses to what's happening on TV. I don't own a TV myself, so I'm just asking you. I think this is going into me, a suspicion on my part actually about what I've been hearing tonight, like this assumption that there's a dearth of collective joy in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's because the things that are actually happening we're so used to become invisible to us as critics or to you as a critic. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about that from the perspective that maybe you're missing? Do you think it's possible that something like TV might actually be a collective, joyous experience?
Offhand, no. No, I mean, that's a spectacle. And the overall, you know, historical trend was the replacement of potentially disruptive, potentially politically disruptive collective festivities and rituals with spectacle. When you watch television, as if you watch a fascist rally, no creativity is required on your part. There's nothing is asked from you. No muscular involvement is asked from you. Nothing. It's the creativity has all been centralized, and then is put forward before you. Do you think I'm being fair, Amy, or am I overly harsh? I mean, I do watch TV.
If you look at the brain waves that are generated when you watch TV, there are a high number of alpha waves, which are the same ones that you have when you're in a coma. So it has kind of a very dulling effect rather than an ecstatic effect. So, yeah. She's saying maybe TV isn't the best choice, but I think that more general comment is, are we missing things in our own culture because they've taken a new form than what we've seen in the past, and so we don't think that they count. But I think you addressed that through the ritual of sports, for instance, and carnival.
Yeah, new things have been coming up.
Raves, rock and roll. Well, thank you very much for all of your questions and for being here tonight. And thanks to Barbara.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.